So this message today is a result of a phone call I received a couple of weeks ago from a church member, not in this area, and also an email that I received from a church member, not in this area. So don't try to guess who it might be, because they're not in this area. Anyway, this individual, the one that called me, asked me if I had read this article or letter written on ancient parchment that was discovered, purported to be a letter from Pontius Pilate to Emperor Tiberius. And supposedly this letter from Pilate to Tiberius contained some information, description about Jesus Christ. But in the letter, Pilate describes what Jesus looked like. And so just from what this individual was saying to me over the phone, I said, no, that's a bogus, that's not true. But they wanted to argue about it. They seemed to think that it might be. And so I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll do some research on the subject and I'll get back to you. So in my research, I found that there were actually two letters, that state almost the same description about Jesus. Not quite, some of the details vary. But the second letter is purported to have been written by a man named Publius Lentulus. I don't know if you've ever heard that name before. Who is said to have been the governor in Jerusalem. And so I read a portion of this letter. So I'm going to share this with you of what supposedly this individual wrote. He says, Lentulus, the governor of the Jerusalemites, to the Roman Senate and people, greetings. There has appeared in these times and still is a man of great power named Jesus Christ, who is called by the Gentiles the prophet of truth, whom his disciples call the Son of God, raising the dead and healing diseases, a man in stature, middling tall and comely, having a reverend countenance, which they that look upon may love and fear, having hair. So here he goes into the description. Having hair of the hue of an unripe hazelnut. I'm not sure what an unripe hazelnut looks like. But anyway. And smooth, almost down to the ears. But from the ears down, in curling locks, somewhat darker and more shiny, waving over his shoulders. Having a parting at the middle of the head, according to the fashion of the Nazarenes. So keep that in mind. According to the fashion of the Nazarenes. A brow smooth and very calm, with a face without wrinkle or any blemish, which a moderate color makes beautiful. With the nose and mouth, no fault at all can be found. Having a full beard of the color of his hair, not long, but a little forked at the chin, having an expression simple and mature, the eyes gray, glancing and clear. In rebuke, terrible. In admonition, kind and lovable. Cheerful, yet keeping gravity. Sometimes he wept, but he never laughed. I find that interesting. He said that Jesus Christ never laughed. In stature of body, tall and straight, with hands and arms fair to look upon, in talk grave, reserved and modest, so that he was rightly called by the prophet fairer than the children of men. So I'll stop right there. That was his description. So what's interesting, the other letter floating around on the internet, supposedly written by Pilate, describes the physical appearance of Jesus, but From his description, it varies in some of the details. The most obvious reads this way. His cheeks without spot or wrinkle, beautiful with a lovely red. And then instead of gray eyes, the letter says, his eyes a bright blue. Bright blue. All right. So let's fact check these letters, shall we? Fact check. We do that often. First of all, I found there's no record of this man, Publius Lentulus, found in the ancient archives. Probably because Pontius Pilate was the governor assigned to Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, and not this man. We know that. It was Pilate that we read about in the scriptures. Now, in my research, I found articles written by two men who have done their own research on this subject, research on these letters. The first one is written by Brandon T. Ward. You can write that down, Brandon T. Ward, if you want to find his writings. Published in 2022 and recently updated in 2023, June of 2023. So very, very recent. But Brandon, this gentleman, Mr. Ward, received a copy of these two letters from a church, not one of ours, and after reading them, decided to do some research of his own. So here's what he writes. This is what he writes. He says, a few years ago, I decided to revisit this subject. That's when I discovered Christian scholar Dr. Edgar J. Goodspeed had long ago debunked the description of Jesus' letter. So Mr. Goodspeed would be the authority on this research. And this, Mr. Ward continues here. He says, I wish I knew then what I know now at this moment, because he had kind of bought into this idea of the description of Jesus in these letters. He said, I was quite shocked since the church, whoever this church was, the sending his letters, knew who Dr. Goodspeed was, as they cited his other works, not just this one. They ignored his research on this one. So let me share with you what Dr. Goodspeed says in regards to his research. He says, a document known as the Description of Christ has of late reappeared in religious papers and books in various parts of the United States. In recent years, I have received copies of them from all parts of the country. In a well-known Berry Ranch near Los Angeles, the document is on display together with a portrait of Christ. Now, where'd that come from? Because it's presented as an ancient and presumably authentic document, it's worthwhile to state the facts about it. So Dr. Goodspeed goes on to state, the letter probably originated, note where he, in his research, found that it originated from. He says, the letter probably originated in Italy in the 13th century. There are no records of the letter's existence before that time frame. And then he continues, in a number of medieval manuscripts, the description appears in a longer form in a letter from, then he mentions, Publius Lentulus, governor of Judea to the Roman Senate. Two important notes here. The letters are always a little different. However, if they were true historical account, they should be nearly the exact match. Moreover, as I mentioned, Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea, not this other man, which history has no record of. So I'm in there with Mr. Ward's commentary and his findings and the research by Dr. Goodspeed. Now, I also found out that it's claimed that there's a copy of these letters contained in the Library of Congress. This is not true. Letters were written to the Library of Congress asking if these letters had been archived there in the library. And letters were written back saying, no, there is no record. Not only that, but deeper research, as I begin to look into this even more, revealed there's a book with numerous transcripts of supposed interviews of a number of individuals mentioned in the scriptures. And it's called the Archco Volume. It's a book. Contains all these manuscripts of interviews from people like Mary, the mother of Jesus, some of the disciples, and on and on. But the Archco volume does not provide us with an accurate account of events in the first century, as it claims to be. So here's what they found. Rather, it's a poorly written hoax that was dated from the 19th century by a certain Reverend W.D. Manhan. So you don't know these things until you start looking into them and research. Other research on these letters reveal that most believe the artist renderings that one might see today of Jesus more than likely were taken from these descriptions of him in these forged or fraudulent letters. So we could stop here. We could stop here and end with the conclusion that these letters are forgeries from our research, that they were inaccurate, and the accounts are of events, therefore, of what has been written are false. But I don't want to stop here. I don't want to stop here. According to the scriptures, brethren, according to the scriptures, let's unpack what we've discussed thus far. Let's do that. So first, let's look at this. The letter mentions Jesus had long hair, and his beard was after the fashion of the Nazarenes. Remember they said it was from the Nazarenes. That's how they wore their hair and their beards. Now, Nazarene is a title used to describe people from the city of Nazareth in the New Testament. And there is some research, things that you could read about that. But I won't take the time to do that. But I was unable to find anywhere in research that men from Nazareth wore their hair differently than anyone else at that time. So I was unable to find that the Nazarenes wore their long hair, had a certain type of beard or whatever. Couldn't find that. What they're actually alluding to in the support of a long-haired Jesus is the idea that he was under a Nazarite vow. You've probably heard this before, that he was under a Nazarite vow. And so they're mixing up Nazarite vow. What is a Nazarite vow? Let's take a look at that. Let's go to Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6, I'm going to begin in verse 1. What are the requirements to be under a Nazarite vow? Take a look at this. I'm only going to touch on three here that are mentioned. I'm not going to go through the entire chapter, number 6. So, Numbers chapter 6 and verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord. So an individual could take this vow, separate themselves. A mother or father could set aside their child, consecrate their child to God, or God could choose someone. But here are the three of the requirements. Verse 3. He shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink, Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor any fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin. So no wine, no grape juice, nothing associated with the grape. Verse 5. All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head until, note this, until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of his hair, of his head, grow. So he couldn't cut his hair until the vow ended. Verse 6. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. So no wine drinking, don't cut your hair, don't go near a dead body. Just mention those three. Now, there's three individuals mentioned in the scriptures who are set apart by God. First, Samuel. You can read 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11. I won't take the time to go there. Read that verse, Samuel, 1 Samuel 1, verse 11. See what it says about Samuel. And then we have Samson, who was a judge over Israel. Read chapter 13 about him. See what it says. And then we have John the Baptist. John the Baptist. Let's read about John the Baptist. Let's go to Luke chapter 1. Let's do that. Let's go over to Luke chapter 1. I'm going to begin in verse 13. Because we know that John was set aside for a very specific purpose. Luke chapter 1, breaking into the account here, verse 13. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zacharias, for your prayer is heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink." So there's our indication. "He shall also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even with his mother's womb. And he will turn away many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God." So like I said, John set aside this Nazarite vow. And so his physical appearance, the very fact that he would not cut his hair, people would notice he didn't drink wine, he couldn't go near a dead body, would show that he was under this Nazarite vow. So the question we need to ask then, did Jesus do any of these three don't do's of someone under a Nazarite vow? Did he ever do that in his lifetime that would demonstrate that he's not under vow? Okay, let's take a look. Let's go. Well, first of all, I'll mention this. This is not proof, but it's something to consider. So his first miracle, he turned water into wine. Now, you could argue, well, he turned water into wine, doesn't mean that he drank that wine. You could argue that point. But we can set aside that and say something else would demonstrate that he probably did. Let's go to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, these are verses that we typically read around the Passover. I'm going to begin in verse 27. So he's with his disciples on the Passover, and he says to them, it says he took the cup, gave thanks, and he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it all of you. For this is the blood of my new covenant, which is shed for many of the remissions of sins." So there was symbolism in this wine then. But here's the key verse, verse 29. "But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on, until the day that I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." So a statement like that obviously proves that he was drinking wine. He was drinking wine with his disciples that night. And he told them, look, moving forward from now on, I'm not going to do it again until we get together again in the kingdom. Well, obviously, he wouldn't, because he was going to be crucified. So, Jesus Christ drank wine. No, if you're under Nazarite vow. How about going near a dead body? Let's go to Matthew chapter 9. Just one account here in Matthew chapter 9. Let's begin in verse 23. Matthew 9, verse 23, when Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd wailing, he said to them, "Make room, for the girl's not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. So she is actually, she's dead, but he's using this term, she's just sleeping, because it was going to be temporary. But when the crowd was outside, he went in, he took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went out into all the land. So Jesus Christ resurrected this little girl from the dead. So not only did he go near the body, but he touched the body. So point number two. Now, here's the biggie. Did Jesus Christ have long hair? Did he have long hair? Well, we've already demonstrated he wasn't under a Nazarite vow. So why would he have long hair? Why would he have long hair? What would be the reason for him to have long hair? Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, if you would. 1 Corinthians would have subjected himself to what Paul wrote here in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Because we need to understand what Paul wrote here was what God inspired. And Paul was teaching against some of the Gentile practices regarding a man or a woman's hair. And of course, there are spiritual and authoritative implications in these scriptures. But that's for another day and another message. But I just want to touch on what Paul was writing to the Corinthian church here. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14 says, "Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering." And then he says, "But if anyone seems to be contentious," so if anyone here doesn't agree with what I'm saying, he goes on to say, "We have no such custom, nor do the churches of God." So there were some of these customs, long hair, shaving the head, and Paul had to deal with that. But he said, in God's church, we don't practice that. So God would not have inspired Paul to write this if it didn't apply to Jesus Christ and the disciples. Now, I don't know how many of you might have watched this series out called The Chosen. In that, Jesus has long hair. Some of the disciples have long hair. Not all of them. Some do. But outside that crowd, if you've watched the series, most of the people have short hair. They're not depicted with long hair, but Jesus is. So what did Jesus look like? Anybody know? Can you answer that question? What did Jesus look like? We don't know. That's the answer, really. We don't know exactly what Jesus looked like. Now, we can make some assumptions. We could assume that he looked Jewish, considering his mother was Jewish and he had her DNA flowing through his veins. We know her lineage can be traced back to King David. His stepfather could, even though Joseph was just his stepfather. But if you read Luke's genealogy, You can see that his genealogy through Mary could be traced back to King David. So can we make some assumptions based, and this is key, based upon what the scriptures say, not what some bogus letters might say? Let's go to Isaiah chapter 53. See what was written about him in Isaiah chapter 53. I'm going to begin in verse 1. Isaiah 53, verse 1. Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And this is talking about Jesus Christ here. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of the dry ground. He has no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. That makes it fairly plain. We got to remember what the scriptures say. God says he is more interested in the heart than what someone looks like. Let's go to Philippians chapter 2. I'm going to begin in verse 5, Philippians chapter 2. Paul writes, he says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Jesus Christ, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God. But he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Now, we can read numerous accounts where Jesus Christ was able to pass through a crowd unnoticed. And when Judas Iscariot brought the mob to the garden, he had to betray Jesus Christ with a kiss to his cheek, which was a cultural greeting then, at that time. Otherwise, you get the implication that he wouldn't be recognized unless Judas did that. Now, if Jesus were, if he was very tall, if he was light-skinned with long, flowing, brownish-reddish hair and these piercing blue eyes, you would think he would be easily recognized. Do you think Brad Pitt would stick out in a group of Jewish men? I would think so. You've seen the features. Different nationalities have different features. Jesus Christ would have looked like a typical Jewish man. There would have been no reason for God to have Jesus Christ born from Mary to look extremely different than anybody else. So there's numerous explanations to how Jesus came to be betrayed with long hair. One was the false belief that he was under a Nazarite vow, which he wasn't. We've talked about that. Another explanation was the Romans, who viewed Jesus as a son of a god, possibly a son of a pagan god. They viewed him that way. They likened him to one of their pagan deities like Apollo or others, which are depicted in some sculptures with long hair. Maybe you've seen some of those. Now, others believe that a particular church denomination, yielding much influence and power, set out to end anything associated with Jewish practices. We know that for a fact. If you know the history, even the history of God's church. Therefore, they felt it necessary to move Jesus away from anything Jewish, even in appearance. Remember where this letter came from? One of them, anyway. From Italy. So I wanted to unpack this false conception of Jesus Christ and discuss these letters with you. Because modern day Christianity have a totally false image of Jesus Christ. And that image hangs on their walls at home. This artist's renditions. It hangs in their churches. And it's in their mind. When they imagine Jesus Christ, this is what they see. But I wanted to, like I said, unpack this false conception of Jesus and these letters, because I'm going to be driving to a main point in this message towards my conclusion. I really won't reveal my main point until I get close to the end of this message. But I want to first share this with you. I mentioned I had received this phone call. The same week I received an email from another church member, not in this area, who does not attend with us. Well, the email contained a Word document with multiple questions. And believe it or not, the questions pertain to Jesus Christ. I was a little bit dumbfounded. Honestly, I was somewhat taken back by the drift away or loss of understanding this individual once had about Jesus Christ and all the prophecies written about him. Now, we've seen this happen over the years. But with this individual, I was a little bit surprised. But I didn't reply to the individual, and I did reply to the individual, but I didn't answer the questions. Maybe I will. Maybe it'll make a good Bible study. But I did reply to the individual, and I recommended where this individual could go and study for themselves to once again prove what they believed at one time. I recommended they go to our church's website, do some research, look at our literature. There's also some great literature on the Herbert W. Armstrong Library. Great articles written years ago covering all these subjects. So, brethren, there is a lot of disinformation floating around out there about Jesus Christ, God the Father, and their relationship. And unfortunately, it's finding its way into the homes and minds of God's people. Is it truly that important what Jesus Christ looked like? Yes and no. Yes. Because if someone comes to you and presents letters such as this, or they call you, and they seem to have latched onto these ideas, then you should be able to go and prove that they're not true. So in that regard, yes, it's important. But I say no, because like I mentioned, it's not important what Jesus looked like. What's important is who he was. Who he was. What he taught, what he said, what he accomplished, and what he's going to accomplish in the future. For us, that's the most important thing. Not to get caught up on these trivial ideas of what he might have looked like. Of course, false information, latching on to a lie, is nothing new and probably will continue until Christ returns, I would imagine. Because we know that Satan is always on the attack to try to destroy God's people and God's truth. And a tactic, we heard a message about the tactics of Satan and the things that he does. Well, one thing that he does, and that is he works on our human nature. He wants to pique our interest in something that looks new and different and interesting. He works on us that way. And we have to have the ability to recognize that and to put it down, put it aside. Because, brethren, there is coming a time when there is going to be a great, great deception coming upon this world prior to Christ's return. And exactly how it's going to play out, we're not sure. But there's going to come two individuals who have power and authority to deceive. Often wonder, will he have the ability to convince the entire world as Adolf Hitler did with the German people? And that was, he was the only hope for the German people's survival. He convinced them of that. I recently watched a series focused on World War II. It was a good series. They colorized it, which made it more interesting. But it's hard, as I watched it, extremely hard to watch the atrocities that Adolf Hitler was able to convince his people to carry out against other human beings. It was hard to watch. And when the American troops finally moved into some of these death camps, they call them prison camps or work camps, death camps, some of those generals, and it depicts this in this series, were so shocked and sickened they couldn't watch. They couldn't look. They had to turn and leave. So obviously we know that this man, Adolf Hitler, was a tool in Satan's hands. But he was also led to believe that he needed to establish a pure race. And he convinced the German people that the Jews were to blame for all the problems. Adolf Hitler, the leader of the Nazi Party, argued that the Germans were superior to all other races. Hitler became obsessed with racial purity. And he used the word Aryan to describe the idea of a pure German race. You probably heard the word, Aryan race. He believed the Aryan race had a duty to control the world. The Nazis believed that the Aryans had the most pure blood of all people on the earth. And notice this. Here's what he believed. The ideal Aryan had to have pale skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. Interesting. Now, brethren, for all of us in God's church, I don't think our looks will be a factor in our persecution. Rather, it's going to be what we believe and what we stand for. It's going to be what's in here and up here. And I think we all understand that there is a time of testing coming for all of us. We see the winds of change in this nation, which at one time we could say was somewhat of a godly nation. But brethren, evil men with great power are coming. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13, if you would. Revelation chapter 13, I'll begin in verse 1, but here's where we read about these two individuals and the power and the authority they have and what they'll set out to accomplish. Revelation 13, verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him its power, his throne, and great authority. So we see where this individual gets his power from Satan himself. And I saw one of the heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. All of the world. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who's like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And notice verse 7. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. An authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And then he says here, here is the patience and the faith of the saints. All right, let's take a look at the second beast. Let's continue on in verse 11, a different beast. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a lion. So we know this is the false prophet. And he exercises all authority of the first beast in his presence, and he causes the earth and all who dwell, those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire to come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he is granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on the right hand or on their foreheads. Brethren, we might be forced to do this. And we're going to have to reject it. So that no one may buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. His number, 666. And we know that Jesus gave warning to his disciples in Matthew 24. What did he say? He said, this deception is going to be so great that if it were possible, you and I, the saints, could be deceived. So I would take that to mean extremely deceptive on how they bring this about. Now, for those of you that have been in God's church for 28 years or more, have witnessed the power of deception and how many succumb to those lies. And looking back, we always talk about it. It's difficult to understand how that could happen, how it's possible. But it is, unfortunately. I'd like you to go to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21 is a parallel account of Matthew 24. And this is Jesus' end time prophecy. And he tells his disciples something here that is somewhat unsettling. For me, anyway, when I read it. And remember, he's sharing end time conditions here in Luke chapter 21. Let's begin in verse 10. Then he said to them, "Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilence. And there will be fearful signs and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. And you will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake." So we know that some of these things happened during the time of the disciples. We know that it's happened to God's church through the centuries. But he says, "It will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist." And here's, to me, somewhat of an unsettling verse. Verse 16. "You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake." But here's the encouraging last two verses. "But not a hair of your head will be lost. And by your patience possess your souls." So if we remain steadfast, don't allow ourselves to be deceived, God will take care of us. But why would people betray us? People who are family, friends, and relatives. Why did the German people betray their Jewish neighbors? The series I watched talked about how some of the Jews in Germany were close friends with some of the Germans, close friends, associated with them, worked with them. Kids went to school together. But yet they betrayed them. They turned them in. Now there were some Germans who rescued some of the Jews, which is a credit to them. But many betrayed their neighbors. So, brethren, under the right conditions or for justified reasons, humans might do anything. Don't be fooled. Often out of self-preservation or fear, people, or hunger, starvation, people will do things that maybe they never believed they would do. So, brethren, the last thing that any of us in God's church would ever do is to allow ourselves to succumb to this soon coming beast power and false prophet. But how are we going to do that? How are we going to resist? How are we not going to take that mark? What's it going to take? Well, one way is not to allow ourselves to be fooled, deceived by some of these false teachings and ideas that continue to circulate around on social media and the internet, because they're out there. Brethren, honestly, why do we need any other doctrine or supposed new truth that someone is advocating? Why do we want that? Why do we listen to that? Why do we need that? We know what we need to know. Right here. We know what we need to know. We know what we need to do to get into God's kingdom. We have our doctrines. We remain true and faithful to these doctrines. We don't need anything new. We don't. How is it that some individuals feel that they have this truth and nobody else understands it? Only they understand it. Nobody else understands it. And so they put themselves on a pedestal and they set themselves up as, I'm the guy that knows and they don't. Now, if God wants to reveal something new to us, He's going to do it. He'll do it through the ministry. He'll do it through the majority. If it's important to Him. I'm not saying that, now doctrinally we're sound, we're together. There are twiggy issues. There are things that we might not totally agree on. But you know what? Not going to keep us out of the kingdom unless we make it an issue. We're not going to lose our salvation unless we start chipping away at doctrine. You know, there appears to be one common denominator that I've noticed with individuals, maybe some of the ministry as well. With these individuals, the one that called me and the one that wrote me the email. One rarely attends Sabbath services, and the other one not at all. So they have cut themselves off from the body. They're out there, as someone said, as I was talking to someone this afternoon. They're out in the desert. They're out in the desert. And I have witnessed and I have seen what happens when they do that. They open their minds to so much, what's the word I want to use? So many lies. They go looking, they go cruising, they look on the internet. What's this guy saying? What's he believe? Oh, that's interesting. Huh, could he be right? Could we be wrong? And they create confusion in their minds, and pretty soon they just start to wonder. I've talked to individuals about how important it is to be here. Because we need to be here. We have the ministry that's teaching us the truth. Hopefully, we do here. And you have each other. You have each other to discuss these things. Hey, I got this letter. This guy called me about this. What do you think? Well, I don't know. It doesn't sound right to me. How about we do some research on this? Or let's go to Mr. Sexton, Mr. Dick. Or some of the elders here. Let's ask them. Have you heard about this? What do you think? It's iron sharpening iron. We need that. so we don't start wandering off. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 10, if you would, please. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23 through 25. There's a valid reason that the author of Hebrews wrote what he did here. Obviously, he saw the same problem. He writes about the same problem. Hebrews 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. Hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assemblies of ourselves together, as in the manner of some, but exhorting one another. And this is vital, especially at this time for us, and so much more as the day approaches. The day is approaching, which it is. So, brother, my main point is found here in my conclusion. Satan, using men, will try to pull you away from the foundation and truth of the scriptures contained in the Bible. And hopefully none of us here are trending that way. I don't believe so. But as this age comes to an end, brethren, the pressure to compromise will grow stronger. It's going to. But we know what is true and what isn't. So like I said, there's no need to look elsewhere for what someone might say is a new truth or understanding, which most often really is just a circulated lie. It's been around. Just making its way around again. But brother, if we stay close to God, the Father and Jesus Christ, and hold on to faith once delivered, we won't be fooled and believe the lie. We won't be fooled by false letters or erroneous emails that might come our way. So brethren, study and pray and be here. Be here on the Sabbath. I realize, I speak to some of you out there, I know some of you can't be. But listen in, because all the truth and understanding we have is right here. And also, I'll leave you with this. Please remember this. There should be more to a man than just looks. Have a great Sabbath.